act as a coil in the unspecified length of the fuse. That we could treat it as a coil, but that actually made the whole confusion. Sorry about it.
It's okay, Wesley, but that was the major problem with that subject, that we were off chasing something totally unrelated to what you were talking about, because when we hear blowing up like a fuse, we assume you're talking about something like a fuse. You're just talking about, you could say, I have a firecracker. It blew up like a fuse. We would then not discuss fuses. We would discuss firecrackers.
Okay, let me go to another one. It's the antennas. Interesting for Schumann resonances, which is 8 to 45 hertz, was the concept on 20th of this month that I sent you in the email, and Schumann resonance is a set of spectrum peaks in extremely low frequency, ELF portion of the Earth electromagnetic spectrum. So that's between the ionosphere and the Earth, and it's due to lighting. That article is from 2000, I believe, two, and it's with pictures. So he proposed the antenna that was buried in the ground, and it used a 22 telephone wire, so a 20 conductor telephone wire, and was So each wire in that loop was connected to another wire, and to another wire, and to another wire, and to another, so all pairs were used, and was coupled, picking a frequency of 25 kilohertz on VLF region, and even using 50 hertz and lower. So that is a concept that I never thought about it. I wonder if anybody thought about buried antennas in the ground for low frequency intuition.
Well, I certainly haven't. Probably not going to start. They're very inefficient. Matter of fact, for anyone who heard earlier, I have a link page with articles. One of the articles I put on the link page is an article about can we store energy from lightning? It's a question that showed up on one of my scientific journal websites, and it's answered by a gentleman called Professor John Fletcher. Apparently, he's the director of the UNSW Digital Grid Futures Institute, and he's also from the School of Electrical Engineering and Telecommunications. So if you guys have nothing better to do sometime, they'll be up for the foreseeable future. Just look up the article. It says, shocking question, can we store the energy from lightning?
Yeah, interesting. I don't believe that it could be done. At least technically it's difficult. Interesting.
Yes, that was his ultimate reply, that you can't really do it.
But what you can do is, it's not energy from the lightning, it's that lightning is the cause of the electromagnetic waves in Schumann waveguide, so that would be the electromagnetic energy that could be received. And when we're talking about the ground waves, then we could go further to an interface which is actively used by today's electronics in microstrips at certain frequency, which is not the frequency of what we're talking about, where you have the interface between the electric and the conductor, where in our case that would be Earth as a lossy conductor and IR as a dielectric, but we're not going to go there.
No, I don't think we should go there. You know, I mean, it would be nice, and people have tried it. And modern technology, just kind of breaking it in half, just the part about beaming electrical energy across the room. There are somewhat inefficient but successful modes like Qi charges and such, but there's probably a dozen or two dozen patented technologies to do similar stuff that never took off the ground. So it's a very flighty industry with problems, and I don't know if I want to have large amounts of RF going through me to my to operate my cell phone and such. I do use the Qi chargers. They're very, very short distance chargers. They're not terribly inefficient, but they are more inefficient than a wired connector. I guess I'm lazy that way. But I don't think there's going to be that much wireless large power transfers in the foreseeable future.
Well, you might be completely right in what you're saying. In microstrips at the high frequency, we have the interface where the electromagnetic energy in TM mode, transverse magnetic mode, is simply trapped in it. And so it's from one side given to it from the transmitter, and from the other side is received. It's normal. It's right now everywhere. So but the conclusion is that if we have a certain angle edge, which is called Brewster angle, but it's not an angle, it's a complex angle structure, we could actually trap the electromagnetic energy that is in the Schumann waveguide and send it through the Earth-Air interface and eventually receive it. So, but we're not going to go there. The next antenna is the octoloop antenna, which is a vertical antenna that looks kind of squarish, but it's octoloop, like octoloop. And that one was made with 100-pair telephone wire that... where the each pair of each wire of the telephone wire, the telephone wire was connected one to the other in the loop, so it actually was like 2,650 square meters area window. And that was used by the same guy in the frequency 1 to 8 kilohertz, which is actually the fundamental frequency of Schumann waveguide, right, Schumann frequency, and that is 87, I believe, of hertz, the fundamental frequency going out to 45 hertz. And to
VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Good evening, gentlemen. I have a question on the topic that you're on right now that might be of interest to a lot of folks. Jim, KD2VHD. So I would imagine that while lots of folks blow off the long-distance power transfer that Nikola Tesla had in mind, obviously the newer technologies with cell phones are demonstrating that close-range transfer of electrical power has some practical applications. Could you, either of you folks or any others, imagine the situation where we would have, let's say, an express lane on the highway that an electric car could couple into a close-range, under-road bed source of electric to charge batteries, run the car, and extend range, and solve some of the issues that we're dealing with, because batteries certainly don't solve it. And I know this is a whole segue, but I think it's a valid segue. I figured I'd throw it out there. KD2VHD.
Okay, Jim, let me see if I have the repeater, and I'll say my piece, and if Wesley has something, he can then say his. Okay, I have the repeater. Good. Very, very energy inefficient. Wireless conduction of energy is possible. As I mentioned, the Qi chargers that a lot of our cell phones and little earpieces charge on, but the efficiency goes down. So you're wasting more energy than if you're plugging it into a wire. So that's number one. You have to build infrastructure. And especially since these are roads, you have to build serial infrastructure that would be cost prohibitive. And if any structural damage happened along the road, the power would go out and all the cars would stop. So although it's interesting and it's something that in a wired condition is implemented in monorail technology and train technology, certainly, to take it to a wireless version would probably introduce so many cost problems and technical problems that it would make the Hyperloop seem like an actually good design.
US to one.
Yes, Paul.
Last couple of years, I've watched. They have these Formula E races, and they go around country to country. But when it comes to the States, they go to Brooklyn, somewhere near the Battery Tunnel. I think they took a part of part near the shore, and they set up the track, and they look like Formula One racing cars, but they're all electric. Goes zooming around the circuit. It's not an oval; it's a circuit track. But at some point, they're allowed a couple of times during the race to go near this wall. And when they go near the wall, they gain a charge. So these things are never recharged during the whole race. But they do gain some power when they go near this wall, and then they're able to go a little faster and maybe beat the other guy. And I tried looking on the internet to try to figure out how this works. I don't know how it works, but apparently they must have some sort of transformer technology. The wall must be a primary, and the car must be a secondary. Something's going on there. And if you ever find anything on the internet on how that works, I'd like to know. But they do have that. Of course, yeah, you could have put this out on the LIE somewhere, But for a small little course like they have set up in Brooklyn every year now, it's pretty interesting. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, most likely it's an inductive coil. There's a transmitter, a receiver. They do a degree of handshaking. Otherwise, they might blow out any kind of stray inductance that it picks up and thinks it's a receiver for its power supply. A lot of things use that type of technology. Chi-Square uses it, Qi-Charge. If you take them apart, there's a little inductive coil on both sides and some integrated chips. I have a levitating moon sphere that lights up the floating moon using an inductive power source coupling to the levitating globe. So it's doable, but it's inefficient. So and I guess if you go around in circles, it makes engineering a lot easier. So maybe everyone should just drive in circles.
Okay. The concept doesn't have to be closed coupling. Doesn't have to be looking for one coil on the surface, the other one over the surface of the road, or any kind of closed coupling in the closed field. The concept of energy in the interface was pretty much known since 1952. There was a gentleman named Gobau who was following a concept of Sommerfeld and sending energy over one wire, but actually it wasn't the wire. It was in the space between the electric and the wire, what was mentioned by Dick a long time ago, was used by Dr. Gobo, and it's being called right now Gobo Summerfield transmission line. So we have the interface between the electric and the copper, which is the copper that is covered with the dielectric, with the NMAL or the Teflon in it, and that energy travels in that space, in that interface. So you can receive it from the other side, although it's very much not practical. That's one of the things. You can find it in Wikipedia. It's a very much known and checked concept. The second concept was that any dielectric and any conductor could be used as an interface at given condition and the frequency, and that was using micro strips. It was replicated in thousands. Then people thought, how about if we go for any kind of other interfaces, and that would be air as the dielectric and earth as the partially lossy conductor. But that, even though that it had a 200 buttons by PhD of electric, the electric engineer PhD, Dr. Corum, that actually end up with the company going to the bankruptcy. That would be the official, what we know about it, apart from other sources which I think are very much promising and potential. But if we say that the road is then the soil and covered with whatever the pavement, and on the top of it there was the dielectric, if it was true to be done, then you could have somewhere the transmitter, you have the interface, and you have a receiver at your car. Unfortunately, there is no evidence that it is working. Enter it, please.
I would think that the fact that it's not working is an important fact, personally. So you mentioned the G line, which we talked about and Dick talked about, but that's not wireless. That's a line. It's called the G line. So the G Summerfield line, Gabo Summerfield line, whatever you want to call it. It's a line. It's not a wireless. So there's no technology presently that can do it. And as I mentioned to Jim, theoretically, if you were insane and you put a lot of inductive coils, because right now the only effective means is to transfer energy in the near field. Once you get past the near field, you're not going to be transferring any kind of significant amount of energy that you would need to make a cargo. So although it's an interesting idea, and I'm sure someone is going to get someone to do a 3D computer graphic and try and sell it on some kind of platform and probably make a few million dollars. Maybe you'd like to try doing that, Jim.
My head, but I heard the guy that invented the internet didn't actually implement it, so I guess that's the stage I'm at. I just figured I'd throw it out there for you to consider. I think it has some merit to talk about, at least. Thanks for letting me throw it in. KD2BHD.
You're welcome, Jim. Anytime. You're always welcome.
I agree with you, Dr. Roy. I'm not talking about wireless. G-line is not wireless, and the interface is not wireless. So when we're talking about, we may look at a form of energy transfer into the interface and from the interface, but other than that, it's a conductor. the strip line is pretty much known. It's nothing new about it. And we're talking about the strip line only in different form. And to actually...
Okay, but ultimately you're not addressing Jim's question. Jim's question was, could you forecast a method to power, externally power an electric car going down the road? So you can't use G-lines and you can't use microstrips. You have to use theoretically things that would apply to that type of environment, which isn't those things.
Not necessarily. When we talk about the interface, we talk about the energy that is being pushed into the interface because that energy was transferred from the vertical antenna at the complex burster angle, which is about 52 degrees, and right after the closed field, or near field, I'm sorry, near field is ended, that the energy is not recoverable. So if we're looking at the G-line, we're looking about the energy that is not recoverable on the length of the G-line. You can only see that the end of it. The same story is with the microstrips. They are fed by an antenna, and with energy is received by an antenna. And to achieve.
Well, you know, I hate to be kicking a dead horse as well as other people, but that's not Jim's question. You're answering a question that I guess you have, but you're not answering Jim's question. This is not pertinent, as far as I can imagine, to the case of a bunch of electric cars that don't have batteries that are getting supplied power externally as they ride down a road.
Yes, I do. In one of the patents of Dr. James Coram, there is a coil receiver that actually is made to receive the energy from the interface and power up the electric motor. The only thing is that such a car was never built. So, from one hand, we may say, no, it doesn't work. And for that point, because there was no presentation of such, we may say, yes, it's a baloney. But who knows? Enter a chain.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Good evening. Did you hear about this, Forever battery? Forever battery is the game changer. I think that even the technology that you're discussing will be a lot different with this new battery.
I would be willing to bet you anything that this is a scam. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can be moved around. Battery does not supply an endless amount of energy. It is beyond the laws of physics. And my guess is you're looking around for interesting things to invest in once again. And this is kind of what you came up with, I guess. It's either hyperbole at the very best or a fraud at the very worst.
Well, the Forever battery supposedly holds its charge. That means that you can drive a car 1,000 miles before you have to charge it again. Probably, from what I can tell, it's like a regular battery, but it's much more efficient and much more, it performs much better. And also it's much lighter and smaller, compact.
Well, people have been looking for more efficient batteries for more than 100 years, and so far they've only come up with lithium, which is decent but not terribly great, and there's nothing really out there that's particularly special. The most amount of energy that you could store up is still limited. Batteries don't just kind of hold charge. Batteries hold charge and use it up with converting it to kinetic energy of motors and heating and electronics and all kinds of things. So you're dissipating the charge over time. And there's only so much charge capacity that any battery has. And there's no technology, even the beloved graphene super capacitor super battery has limitations. So the idea of having some technology that has an almost infinite amount of charge carrying capacity, again, is either hyperbole or fraud.
Yeah, but, you know, it would be really useful if they could develop a battery like this. Specifically, they say that a smartphone can operate for a month before you have to charge it. That would be pretty cool.
VHD.
Yes, Jim. I just want to point out it would even be cooler if we had a time machine, but we're not getting one of those either. Yes, what would you like to say, Jim?
At the risk of being rude, I apologize, but it's going to sound that way. The idea presented is kind of like thinking that hamburgers come from the supermarket. The hamburgers simply are stored in the supermarket before you receive them. It doesn't make them, it doesn't produce them, it doesn't create them, it just holds them for a little while. It's a battery. Supermarket's like a battery. Battery doesn't make electrical power. It's a really lousy way to store electrical power because there's not a better way, but that's all we got. Can I clarify my car idea? I think I might have not presented it quite right.
Okay, feel free.
So, piecing together off-the-shelf technology, tell me if I'm wrong on any one of the points, because I don't think I am. There's e-race cars that drive in New York City, drive next to a wall and absorb some charge from a wall, okay? They're race cars. They're going at insane speeds at high performance with high acceleration. But they're able to get something out of this wall. Okay, so there's an existing technology to transfer power from a wall to a car. I didn't know about that. That's interesting. Now take the idea of the self-driving car, which generally I think we've all acknowledged on this net that is tenuous at best. But in a controlled situation, it could work. Now imagine a situation where you're driving down another expressway and you press a button on your dashboard, on your Tesla, on your dashboard, that says request to merge. And it says merge granted, there's the next exit, let go of your wheel, merges you in, drives you next to the Jersey barrier that has a coupling next to the wall, drives you right next to the wall, and it gives you the minimal amount of energy that you need to maintain your speed. Not a car without a battery, it's a car with a battery that, in the express lane, is traveling very efficiently because it's not being stopped and started. And it's taking power from some kind of coupling. So I'm just piecing together existing technologies that could probably work if they were not all competing against each other. That was my thought. I hope that clarifies where I was going. KD2VHD.
Okay, I mean, competition slows some things down and improves other things, and it depends upon whether it's real competition or crony competition. There are possibly little nooks and crannies where you could give people a little bit of a boost here and there. It would be very limited and very expensive, and I don't know if anyone would pay for it. You know, we kind of took the extreme case of an electrified road, like train tracks and such, because there's a physical example of it. And I think it just doesn't, unfortunately, lend itself to the present design of cars and roads. If you redesign them entirely into an almost, you know, almost like a tram, you know, right two blocks away from me on McDonald Avenue in Brooklyn, you can still see the old tram tracks. They covered it in tar, but they're still there. So those methods are a much more efficient means of supplying electrical power than wireless technologies, which inherently are inefficient.
Understood. Let me see if I have it. importantly, I'm not proposing an all-or-nothing approach. If there was 5 miles of chargeable HOV lane on the expressway, people would either go to it or they would not, and it would either grow or would not. It could be a market-based thing. The idea of all gasoline cars or all diesel cars or all electric cars, because I said so, is a silly idea. But if you presented these options, they could either grow or not based on their success.
Okay, but you'd have to kind of cost it out to figure out what's going on. There was a time where companies were trying to promote solar roads. They were going to put solar panels on the roads themselves and generate power, except that roads do not make very good solar panels. And so it was expensive, and it would break immediately, and it was just an interesting way of investors losing a lot of money. So I would assume that the square yardage or square footage for such a road would be quite cost prohibitive. If someone came to your county and said, we would like to do that for a quarter of a mile of your adjoining road, and it'll only cost a quarter of $1 billion. You want to get your tax money up for that? Yes, David. By the way, I really do want to wrap this up because I don't want to eat away too much of Paul's poor time.
QSL. I just wanted to comment, you know, electric cars, they take a lot of electricity. A lot of the power that comes out of the grid will be ending up in cars, you know. And we have to produce this electricity, you know, somehow. And it's going to cost a heck of a lot of money. You know, every single ampere we have to pay. This is KG2RY.
Yeah, I just want to say that nothing comes free. Electrical energy is energy, and you have to pay for energy. You don't get free energy. So, you have to build the generators, and you have to have transmission lines and all kinds of infrastructure, and there's no free lunch. Wesley, you want to make a closing statement? Because I really don't want to eat up any more space that time.
Shortly, the concept was that since the energy of the lightning produced electromagnetic waves, and those waves, like in high frequencies, can be received by the interface under the complex Brewster angle, then it doesn't matter where the lightning comes, because the waveguide, which is the interface that belongs to, doesn't the inverse square law doesn't apply to the waveguides. It's a little differently being the scene from the perspective of inverse square law. Didn't you jump? Okay. The idea was that we could actually collect that energy and use it for our use, but the question is how much of that energy is. And so far, there is no official information that that would have achieved, even though that was plenty of money pumped into it. Thank you very much for your time. The only few words you can say about 3 years older mother that gave the birth to the twins. So we have the mother that is 3 years old, then her older than her embryos, and she gave the birth to the twins. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, this is basically, unfortunately, clickbait. What it amounts to is a couple who were having fertility problems used in vitro fertilization to develop a viable fetus to have a child. During the procedure, there was more than one fetus produced. They used more than one egg and more than one sperm, and so apparently they had three fetuses that they developed in vitro. The couple took one and implanted it and had a child. The other two they gave to charity, a religious organization that didn't believe in killing viable fetuses. The fetuses were frozen, and 30-plus years ago, later, another married couple who were obviously much younger, because, you know, they're just, you know, they're younger, wanted to have a baby, and they were infertile, and they took the two in vitro fertilizations from the previous couple. So although the age of the fetus is, you know, 30 years or something, you know, it was frozen as a fetus, so it looks like a little baby. For all intents and purposes, the little babies are still little babies. They are not 4 years younger than the 34-year-old mother that incubated the fetuses.
Okay, that would be it. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. And thank you very much to our space report expert for being so patient.
Yes, I double the motion. Paul, thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Please come back next week when we'll try and do this once again. And until then, it's time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul, WS2N. And again, I apologize for delaying you so long, Paul.
No problem. AP2GS, WS2N. And, oh, I forgot who brought up the car with the was having a coil charge the coil. There's a website, many websites that you can go to. You bring up Formula E car and then something called attack mode. That's what they call it, the attack mode. And all I could ever find is, you know, how they do it, the you know, the benefits of doing it, you know, to win a race and all, but nothing technical. But I know there must be a coil in that wall. Very good. All right, let me continue on with the SpaceNet report for us.
Okay, feel free.
Anyway, I think that has promise anyway for some future time, you know, cars being charged. I'm still looking for the 50,000 charging stations that they're going to have to, oh no, wait, 500,000 charging stations that they have to put across the country. I think we're going to have to hold our breath for that too. Anyway, the Orion spacecraft is doing very well. It's now in a distant retrograde orbit. It launched November 16th, and it will be coming back in December 11th, land in the Pacific Ocean. Right now it's orbiting the moon at a very distant mileage, 40 to 50,000 miles away from the moon. It's not even going to make one complete orbit. It's going to be roughly an arc. I mean, it could if they left it there, but that arc alone is going to take 6 days. Originally, they were planning on letting it do one orbit, which would have taken like a couple of 3 weeks. So anyway, they're sending back beautiful pictures of what the spacecraft looks like on the outside. They have four cameras mounted on the solar arrays. The ends of the solar arrays, there's four solar arrays that stick out. So there's four cameras. They're hooked up by Wi-Fi. They don't even use a wire to connect inside, and then that's transmitted back. I think, lately they've been using 2.2 gig transmitting back to the Deep Space Network. And right now, 100% flight. They have... they have the European Space Agency's service module attached to it, and that's providing the propulsion. Those engines are working good. They have reaction control engines to move around and, you know, reorient themselves in space. They have the OMS engine, the orbital maneuver sort of engine that is actually taken from the space shuttle. Retired space shuttle. It was such a reliable engine that they're using that for all these different burns that they have to do. They got up close to the moon. They fire that for a couple of minutes, and that set them out to a distant orbit. And then Friday they had to do one more burn. Very short, like for a little over a minute, and that actually officially put them into that orbit. And the reason they're doing that is now that they're just sitting there, relatively speaking, in one place as far as the Earth is concerned. They're able to test everything. They can test all their electronic equipment. They can test Callisto. That's working fine. They've already done quite a few tests on that. That's where, let's say, mission control speaks into a microphone and a camera, and their picture will pop up on. They are using an iPad, an Apple iPad that's actually in the command module. So if a crew was sitting there, they would see mission control and they would hear his voice. And for now, mission control makes a couple of statements, tells the spacecraft what to do. They'll say, Callisto, turn on this light, or throw that switch, and then after a period of time, that's done, and then mission control could also see what's going on because they have a camera inside the spacecraft. So, we'll see how it goes over the next couple of days. I think we've got about three or four more days that we'll start to bring this thing back. Again, it'll go very close to the moon from the 50,000 mile high orbit. It'll go maybe 80 miles off the surface. And then they'll actually accelerate and break from that orbit and head back to Earth. That'll take about 3.5 days before they get actually from the moon back to Earth. They'll come through with a heat shield. That's the main thing. They want to test the 16-foot diameter heat shield on the bottom of the spacecraft. That should get up to over 5,000 degrees. The parachutes eventually will open when they get, you know, below the speed of sound. Three big parachutes. It'll land in the Pacific Ocean, and they'll have a ship waiting out there that will scoop it up, literally. You know, the ship floats over the craft, and then they pump the water out, and then next thing you know, they have a spacecraft on the ship. And if all goes well, they said 1 year from now, 2024, my guess, probably springtime of 2024, they'll send a crew of four up. And this time they won't go into that distant retrograde orbit. They will go into a tight orbit. They're planning on eventually going into a completely different orbit, something called a halo orbit. That's totally different. The reason for that is that's eventually where the Gateway space station will be located. So we'll see. I have one more net, I think, before they get to the closing of the Orion first test flight. Okay. Talking about the Gateway project. Gateway is another space station that they're going to put around the moon. extreme retrograde orbit. They call it a halo retrograde orbit. And that will go all the way up from around 40,000 miles away from the moon and then get very close, maybe a couple of hundred miles off the surface of the moon. And each orbit will take about 6 days to complete. Now, they've actually started to get funding for this. They're actually building the first segments. First segments are going to be the power propulsion element, and that will be permanently docked or put together with the HALO module. HALO is the habitation and logistics outpost. Will be attached to the PPE, or the power and propulsion element. The HALO is being welded together right now and contracted in Italy. The same people that make the Cygnus spacecraft, so they have plenty of experience doing that. They'll put that together, put these, eventually these two pieces will be put together. The power and propulsion element has thrusters and everything on board, and that also has big rollout solar arrays attached that will eventually give them 60 kilowatts of power. So once that's all set up, probably in 2024, they will launch it out to the moon with a Falcon Heavy rocket that has that capability of lifting, you know, these two heavy objects and putting it all the way into a trip to the moon through a TLI, translunar injection. And then these pieces will be on their own, and they will eventually go into a permanent orbit around the moon. And they will eventually be joined by other pieces. Now, Roy put onto his website a picture I sent him, an exploded view of what the space station will eventually look like. You know, it shows the PPE, the power and propulsion element, shows the HALO module that they're building right now, and it shows a couple of these other modules that will eventually be attached, including, you can see on the picture, a lander. Lander that will be going from the gateway down to the moon. They'll have a port for that, port for the lander, you know, a port for a couple of other modules that will be attached to this thing. Eventually, you have three big modules, living. That's where you'll have three astronauts being able to live within these three main modules. And they'll be up there, you know, not on a permanent basis. They might be up there for, you know, a month or two, and then they'll bring them back. This thing will all be autonomous. It could fly by itself, and they really don't need a crew on board. So that will be intermittent. So you can see that on our roy.accgs.com webpage. Before I move on, any questions or comments? To test out the orbit, make sure that's okay, they sent Callisto out there. That was launched by an Electron rocket a couple of months ago from New Zealand, and it's a spacecraft built by NASA. And they put it into this HALO retrograde orbit, and it's there now, so that's confirming that that's a stable orbit for eventually Gateway. So that also has other technology on board. It's got the ability to send signals to a lunar orbiter that's presently in orbit since 2009, called Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And by sending signals back and forth, checking on the Doppler effect. They'll figure out exactly where Callisto is at all times. And once they establish that, they know that that will also work with Gateway when that space station is in place. Okay, no other comments. The Dragon spacecraft launched a cargo ship with over 8,000 pounds of stuff to the International Space Station. They do this on a regular basis. This is the 26th cargo mission to the space station, you know, just by Dragon. There's other missions that go up there. The Russians are always sending the Progress missions up. With Antares, our launch vehicle, we send up the Cygnus cargo vehicle. Well, this one is Dragon, and they, like I said, 8,000 pounds worth of food, science material, spacewalking equipment, and in the back of the trunk, they have two massive solar arrays. They're actually called ROSA, or solar arrays. Roll out solar arrays, different than the type of, you know, you think of panels opening up, this thing actually rolls out, and it's successfully been done before. They actually have some on the International Space Station already to supplement the power for the space station, and this will add two more to the space station, and eventually they'll send up two more as well. So I thought that was pretty good. They set up all the hardware last time. They did a couple of EVAs. Now they'll do another EVA to eventually actually put the solar arrays out there. After they're hooked up, they roll them out like a shade in your house and start producing power. And with all the different cargo that they did send up, I did find one thing that I found interesting. They said it was going to be a microscope for the astronauts to use. Well, I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, the idea is to take, like, blood samples or any other kind of samples, and you'd be able to look through a microscope and see what the story is. Well, when I brought it up, this thing looks nothing like a microscope. You know, I'm thinking, you know, like a regular microscope. You know, maybe a stereo, you know, vision type of microscope at least, or something. This thing looks like a box. And for some reason you're able to take a slide and then take a slide and put it into this box. And this box is the microscope. And apparently it takes a picture. I guess the astronauts don't even see what the picture looks like. I'm not even sure. But anyway, that picture is sent down to mission control. A doctor in mission control would look at this and say, okay, it's, you know, you've got this disease or that, you know, or maybe they took it from a panel or something and they're trying to figure out what kind of stuff is on the surface. And they'll say, okay, you know, that's safe or maybe not safe, you know, you better get rid of whatever it is. But they said it's the first time that anybody in space has had a microscope. I mean, they do all this stuff. They do DNA sequencing now for the last couple of years, and I guess they haven't sent a microscope. I guess it would be hard to, you know, maybe in, you know, as you're floating around, if you had a real microscope to look through it, you know, try to keep your eye close to a real scope. Anyway, it's a digital thing. They sent a couple of other things up as well, some kind of blood stain system with it. And, you know, apparently you take these slides and put it into the machine and it gets radioed back to Earth for evaluation. I thought that was pretty cool. Anyway, we, you know, again, Dr. Roy put this onto his website. You can take a look and see what I'm talking about. And I don't know. Roy, do you want to comment on this thing? you ever see anything like this? Do they have anything like this on Earth? Like if this, let's say, in Antarctica, you know, and, you know, although I think they always have a doctor down there, and, you know, they'd be able to send, you know, images to through a satellite back to another doctor somewhere in this state. Back to you, Roy. AC2GSWS2S.
Yes, AC2GS. It's basically a black box. It's sealed up so that the astronauts can't break it, I guess. You insert the slides after you've stained them with another piece of equipment, and then the video is transmitted to ground control, where guys who can read microscope slides read the microscope slides. So it's kind of like if you took a microscope, hooked up a lot of solenoids to the manual controls, and sealed it up and just left one slot where you put the slides in.
Very good. Do you think this would have any earthly purpose for doctors here?
Well, I would assume they're going to use it as some kind of diagnostic tool in case the crew gets sick and they want to do a blood smear. They now have the ability to. Whether they're going to learn anything particularly new, I tend to doubt it because, you know, you stain for organisms, and organisms don't spontaneously just occur out of the zero gravity or low gravity. So I think it's more just a diagnostic medical tool for the crew.
Okay, pretty cool. I know they do constant blood tests up there, you know. I remember reading the book about Scott Kelly. You know, he spent a year in orbit, and one of the things he had to do was constantly take samples of his blood, and, you know, they eventually store it. They have big freezers up on the station. And when he's a cargo vehicle, for instance, you know, the one that just went up there with all this stuff, when that one leaves the space station, it comes down on a parachute, and they pick it up in the water. So it has the capability of returning around 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of stuff, mostly science stuff and things, sometimes EVA equipment. I mean, one time they returned a spacesuit, and they had problems with the spacesuit. But it's the only vehicle that we have that can return hardware back to Earth. And they bring, you know, there's these freezers on board that Dragon cargo vehicle.
That time,
they
complete.
All the blood supplies and everything, all the science stuff is frozen, and they put it into these freezers, and that's how they do it, lands in the water. And they bring that stuff back to back to land. That's why they're actually hoping to get the Starliner up and running by Boeing. You know, then that one will eventually land on land with parachutes. But they'll have quicker access to different science experiments that are time sensitive. Another one that should be going up within a couple of years will be the Dream Chaser cargo vehicle. And that looks like the small space shuttle that will be launched on an Atlas rocket and eventually on the new Vulcan rocket docked at the space station. Stay there for, you know, weeks or months, you know, months at a time. I think it has the capability of staying 6 months. And then load it up with anything you want, and it will fly back and land on a runway. And this will have the capability, actually, of going to many different runways, not just the three runways that the shuttle used. The shuttle used one in White Sands, New Mexico. They used another one in California, Edwards Air Force Base, and another one here on the East Coast in Florida, three-mile-long shuttle runway. This thing will be able to, you know, land in a big runway in New York if they wanted to. Any comments?
WB2BXO with a time.
Okay, hi, Frank. Hey, go ahead.